There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Welcome to the ESPN Player Gridiron College Football Show. I'm Simon Clancy, along with Matt Sherry. Coming up this week, we'll discuss young passers, bad Longhorns, State of Florida meltdowns, and we'll assess the rest of the fallout from week one of the season. Plus, we'll look ahead to week two, and inevitably, there'll be a bit of a shuffle at the top of our Heisman board because a lot happened in week one, obviously. So let's get into it. And if you read the college column this week, you'll see we started with the Texas debacle, and it kind of feels like we should start here as well because things have slightly moved on. The background to it, if you missed it, a 34-29 loss by Texas to unranked Maryland, the second straight year they've fallen to the Terrapins. Matt, what's happening in Austin?
I feel like they're almost cursed at the moment. Although sympathy is in fairly short supply from me, because essentially they got rid of Charlie Strong too quickly for my liking, and I don't like Tom Herman. I think he's very arrogant, and I think the local media is turning on him basically for this reason. He is very sure of himself, and he's very arrogant. To be fair, this is a guy who, when they hired him, was the hottest coach in college football. I mean, he'd been great as Ohio State's offensive coordinator in the national championship run. He'd done a really nice job at Houston for one or two seasons, and it looked a great hire, but he's so arrogant, this guy, and there is off-the-field issues now as well in terms of his relationship with Zach Smith, who was involved in the Ohio State case, and reports of him spending $600 at a strip club when he was at Ohio State. And I think that the fact that that information came out kind of shows how he's thought of at Ohio State, because they've clearly leaked that on purpose.
I was going to say, not a coincidence that came out, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, he's had a lot of things to say about Urban Meyer, if I remember, last year, and about Ohio State. And I just think that it's a little bit of arrogance catching up with him. And you can see now that the tide's shifting in terms of perception. And I mean, he's only in year two, but already his seat is warming up. I mean, losing to a team who essentially didn't have a head coach is not a good look. For all, Maryland were particularly impressive in the game. But I mean, man for man, if you look at the two rosters that they've got, Texas should be beating Maryland every week. So it's not good enough, and it's a really bad start of the season for the Longhorns.
Obviously, Maryland's coach is on administrative leave, like you say, so they had a stand-in, which just makes it worse. There was a lengthy weather delay, which kind of helped anybody, but it was the same for both teams. Herman is now 11-10. And that's his record in the last 21 games, which is astonishingly bad. And, you know, makes, I'm sure, Longhorn fans yearn for the glory days of the Mac Brown era. You mentioned the local media. The Dallas Star-Telegram was just one of the papers that laid into him. And across the board, from Austin to Dallas and all points in between, the local media was fairly hardcore in its disdain for his coaching methods, his arrogance, as you mentioned. I just want to read this to you from the Dallas Star-Telegram, just a little line as part of their editorial. No coach in recent memory thrust out his chest, strutted, smacked that bubblegum, scowled, and tried to intimidate the masses while acting as if he owned the place without having done a damn thing on this level more than Tommy Boy Herman. I mean, that is pretty damning, isn't it?
It is, and I mean, you can't go into a program like Texas with that attitude when you haven't proved anything. Because, I mean, these programs are like mini ecosystems in terms of the way they operate in towns and kind of how important they are to a lot of powerful and rich people. Let's be honest. I mean, the boosters at these programs are success stories in their own right in the world of business, and it really can rub people up the wrong way, and I think we're seeing that.
Nowhere more so than in the state of Texas either.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and Austin's slightly different to the rest of Texas. It's a little bit more liberal and a little bit less Texas-y, for want of a better word. But, I mean, it still exists. And also, I think Texas, in the last few years, are a great case study because a lot of people talk about Nick Saban, and the critics will say, well, I could win with that Alabama team. Just look at the amount of five-star recruits Texas have essentially wasted the careers of in the last 5 years. It's incredible, and it shows the value of coaching as well as recruiting at this level. People often hit Nick Saban with the idea that, oh, well, you're just recruiting the best guys every year. They become the best guys because of Nick Saban, and these guys at Texas haven't become the best guys because the coaching hasn't been good enough. For all, I must admit, I do like Charlie Strong, and I think he's a good coach who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. But Tom Herman is just, I think he's a guy who needs to just look in the mirror, to be honest, and see what he really is and maybe assess the way he behaves, because he's not getting through to these players, and clearly he's rubbing a lot of people up the wrong way in the process.
If you're new to college football, and apologies if you're not, but if you are, recruiting is essentially you're bringing in kids from the high school level to help furnish your roster, your team. And it happens every year. Coaches, assistant coaches go out into communities all around the US and try and essentially hire the best high school athletes to come to each school. And, you know, Nick Saban, the reason Alabama are where they are is mainly because they're coached, A, by Nick Saban, arguably the greatest coach in college football history, but B, Saban is as good a recruiter as there is in America. He goes into the living rooms of mums and dads, and often just mums or often just grandparents, and tells these families why that their kids will not only succeed in football but succeed in life. And that's a key part of college football, isn't it? And if you don't know the college football landscape, recruiting is just an enormous part of everything that goes on, and it's happening right now. You know, it goes on throughout the season and up to National Signing Day, which happens early in the year.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, essentially as well, so a lot of these games this weekend, a program will bring in recruits and have them on the sideline at the games so the kids get to experience that. We spoke last year, Simon, to a couple of guys in high school who were essentially heading to the game that we went to the following week, Alabama, Mississippi State, a couple of kids in high school. So it's a really cool process. It's a little bit sleazy as well, or it certainly has been in years gone by. There's a brilliant 30 for 30 documentary, which I think is on ESPN Player, who are the sponsor of this podcast. What's it called, Sam? The Marcus Dupree one? What's the actual title of the documentary?
The Best There Never Was.
The Best That Never Was. A guy who we very nearly met last year, but was in Oklahoma when we'd arranged an interview with him, which was a shame. But that kind of takes you into the world of certainly what recruiting was back in 20 years ago, and thankfully there are a lot more kind of restrictions put upon it now, although I imagine some of the underhand stuff still goes on.
Yeah, if you've never read the book, there's a phenomenal book, which I'm trying to see on my bookshelf, and I know it's somewhere, but it's by Willie Morris about the recruiting of Marcus Dupree, and it's called The Courting of Marcus Dupree. It is a phenomenal read, essentially about the machinations behind the scenes of recruiting to major colleges, because Dupree was really the greatest running back in high school history, and started off just with an insane clip at Oklahoma. And some of those practices don't go on today, but some of them I think probably still do. I mean, and one of those guys that we talked about going to see last year was a defensive end called King Makuta at Troup County, who was committed to Alabama. And again, is going through the process of going to visit different teams. And even last night, and we'll get on to the Florida State debacle in a moment, but Florida State had the number one ranked defensive player on the sideline last night for the Virginia Tech game, which probably wasn't a good look for them given the beatdown that they got. But that happens week in and week out through the season, doesn't it? Recruits turn up to see games, to see the campus, to be, won over, I suppose, because it's almost like a dating process, isn't it? It's like speed dating, really. You get a certain amount of visits to schools and on-campus visits. And, you know, when you're there, you want to be taken to the best places. You want to hang out with the cool people and you want to go to games and watch the team win. So it's very much, it's a very interesting process. We digress a little bit. Ultimately, can Tom Herman survive this? I mean, media availability yesterday, he was citing Of Mice and Men and urging his players to read the John Steinbeck book, which Lord alone knows how that will help them. I mean, he can't survive the year at this clip, can he?
I mean, it's hard, isn't it? I mean, I still think they would. His buyout must be absolutely enormous. So, and Texas, that's less of an issue than other programs. But I think he will get the beginning, up to the beginning of next year. But I mean, it depends, because let's be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if there's more things come out of the woodwork in the whole Zach Smith situation. So the problem he's got is there will be people now who are gunning for him. And if there is a reason given to those people to fire him, then they'll take it. So it's going to be a fascinating few months for Tom Herman.
Not exactly an easy game for them this weekend either. They face Tulsa, good quarterback in Luke Skipper under centre, and Shamari Brooks, the running back, who had 129 yards against Central Arkansas at the weekend. That's not a pushover for Texas, is it? And if they come in the same sort of lackadaisical manner with which they took on Maryland, I mean, there could be a massive upset on the books. It's unlikely, but you just never know.
Yeah, I mean, it would be end of time stuff if there was an upset. But, I mean, the Maryland game was interesting because they went behind early and then they rallied and you thought, well, they'll win now. And then they kind of just fell off the map again. And Maryland dominated after the delay. And I think that's the worst sign. And you could argue that the delay halted their momentum a little bit. But the flip side of that is, I mean, it's just... When you've gone behind in a game you're expected to win and then come back, to then give it back away is a terrible sign. So, listen, I think everybody will be watching that game this weekend intrigued to see what it looks like for Texas.
Let's leave Texas and switch to the state of Florida. Two big games Sunday night and last night involving Miami and Florida State respectively. And both teams were beaten pretty handily. Let's start with last night and just a dreadful start to the Willie Taggart era for the Seminoles. They didn't take advantage of the atmosphere pre-game, which was absolutely bouncing at Doak Campbell. There was just a run of terrible play calling. You know, when they got DeAndre Francois, who looked terrific, I've got to say, looked terrific, especially throwing the ball. And if you're looking, you're projecting NFL caliber quarterbacks, then, you know, he's certainly got that kind of, he's got the arm, he's got the mobility in the pocket, he's got the accuracy that you look for in an NFL quarterback. But, you know, calling run plays in the face of eight-man fronts with Cam Akers and Jack Patrick just going nowhere. Inside the red zone, calling running plays. Just an awful look for Willie Taggart.
I didn't think that I would be more frustrated by coaching performance than I was Michigan's, certainly in the first half. But this more than topped it. I mean, if you could draw up the worst possible start for a head coach at a big program, this was about it. I mean... They just played into... I mean, Bud Foster, the Virginia Tech defensive coordinator, is a legendary coordinator in his own right. Brilliant. I mean, I think he's been there for the best part of 25 years at this point as a defensive coordinator. So he's great at what he does, and it's a young Virginia Tech defense. So a lot of people were intrigued to see what it looked like. And frankly, I thought a lot of the time Florida State played into their hands. I mean, in the first half, I think Florida State outgained them by about 150 yards and were down 17-3. I mean, it's just, it was awful. I mean, the play calling was a joke. And on a multitude of levels, one, the amount of times in the red zone they were just running the ball into stacked boxes and getting nowhere, and essentially going backwards when they were moving the ball. As soon as they got to the red zone, they went in the opposite direction. And then I can't understand a running system in which a guy who got injured in the first game of last season is essentially the lead blocker on several plays. I couldn't understand that either. Listen, Virginia Tech, if their defence is as good as it looked last night, and the defence is pretty much always good, but there was a lot of young guys this year, so it was a question mark for one of the few times. Virginia Tech's a really good team, but they're a really good team who Florida State, at home, should be beating.
Yeah, I mean, just a lot of errors, weren't there? It was, for me,
it was
embarrassing.
We've seen a lot of sloppy football this week, and you always do in week one. I mean, from big programs as well. I mean, that Washington-Auburn game, which we'll get onto, was fascinating, but it was sloppy on both sides, and that's two kind of top 10 programs. So you get that, but I just... There's sloppy, and then there's what Florida State did, which was bad. And really, the waste of what I thought was a very good performance from an outstanding quarterback, because I thought Francois looked really, really good. And the other thing, Simon, is I don't really know what was going on with their blocking schemes. But for all that defence is really good, that there were unblocked guys seemingly on every other play. And I mean, that talks to me about the protections being wrong And yeah, I just thought it was a comedy of errors for Willie Taggart, and certainly an injudicious start to his tenure.
Yeah, I mean, Cole Minshaw, the starting guard, was missing, and Landon Dickerson went out, the right tackle went out of the game with some injury. And then Juwan Williams, the left tackle, and Derek Kelly, the left guard, both left for portions of the game. So it didn't help. But nevertheless, I mean, you talk about the inexperience of that Virginia Tech defense. The linebackers had four starts between them in their career. And yet, you know, you take a guy like Khalil Ladler, the number nine, was making plays all over the field, both in the pass game and against the run.
It looked like a very well-coached unit against a very badly coached unit to me. I mean, that...
It did, but Ladler was sort of jumping plays almost before they were, you know, in a sort of the way that you see Luke Kuechly do it on a Sunday. And now, was that Ladler's phenomenal film study? And who knows? Or was it just really obvious play calling? Because, you know, I don't know. That. I mean, they only averaged 3.4 yards running, yet Cam Akers still had an 85-yard run in amongst that, which makes it even more ridiculous. So...
Yeah, that was basically the only running play that gained anything that wasn't called back for penalty. The one thing I would say is a positive for Florida State. I thought their defense in the second half was incredible. I mean, the second half was essentially, prior to that 85-yard run, Florida State going three and out inside their own 10-yard line, and then the defense, against outrageously good field position, holding Virginia Tech to 0 points up until kind of the air fell out of the stadium when they... again failed on, after the 85-yard run, they essentially failed to convert that into a touchdown. Final thing I'd say as well, another piece of terrible coaching from Willie Taggart is, there was a spell where Florida State essentially scored a touchdown that the refs ruled down on the 1 yard line, and instead of kind of giving it time for the replay officials to have a look at it, they rushed to the line of scrimmage. Committed a false start penalty, and then at that point, they can't review the play again. So that was a touchdown taken off the board, and ultimately they only got 3 points from the drive. So I get tempo, I get wanting to go with it, but I always, the Patriots do this in the NFL quite a lot, and I hate it. I mean, I always think that on the 1 yard line, you're better off almost just taking a step back. People think you'll get a quick score, but it often actually works the opposite way, and the offense ends up with a penalty. So I often think you should take a step back, let the replay officials do their thing, then plot your series. I mean, if you can't get in from the 1 yard line with three downs, then you shouldn't be in football.
You're listening to the ESPN Player Gridiron College Football Show. I'm Simon Clancy, along with Gridiron Magazine editor Matt Sherry. Let's go from the panhandle in Texas down towards the bottom portion of the state, and the University of Miami, who again lost to LSU, and lost... It wasn't as close to the score, and the score wasn't that close, was it? I mean, they just seemed utterly unprepared for the Tigers, who defensively were very strong. But what was most disappointing from Miami, apart from the performance, I mean, Malik Rozier was very, very disappointing, as I'm sure we'll get to, but so much of that NFL-rated talent simply didn't show up. The safety, Jaquan Johnson, was disappointing. Amon Richards, who we talked about going up against Greedy Williams, totally shut down. Joe Jackson at defensive end, who people have talked about being a first-round pick, no bend, no burst, couldn't get around the edge. Shaquille Quarterman, I mean, LSU ran all over Shaquille Quarterman's, you know, linebacking crew, up and down the field. I was just so disappointed with the Hurricanes. I just thought, you know, and the flip side, I thought LSU were terrific under, you know, the Ohio State transfer at quarterback. They ran the ball really well. Ed Ogeron just did a terrific job, I thought.
It reminded me very much of Mark Richt at Georgia. Kind of, you know, Richt had a really good win-loss record at Georgia, but was essentially fired because he couldn't beat Alabama or couldn't win the big game, which is going to be a theme of this episode. And I mean, we saw that a little bit last year at the end of the season, but I said last week I thought Miami caught lightning in a bottle a bit, and this was a big test early in the season, but a very winnable test. It was one of those where they could put a statement win on the board, but frankly, a game that you would probably expect them to win based on last year. And they just didn't show up at all. And it was a worrying sign for Mark Richt, because this has kind of been the theme of his career at this point. I mean, to be at Georgia as long as you did and not win it all is not good enough. I mean, Georgia's basically the hotbed of talent in the US. And this kind of... I don't know if you thought the same, Sam, but it had very much echoes of his Georgia tenure in terms of the team looking totally unprepared for a game and just being outdone by an opponent who, frankly, I don't think are the best coach team in, in college football by any stretch, but they were a lot more prepared for this game. And that was interesting because the commentators kept harping on about the fact that LSU in their practice didn't look well coached. I mean, I don't know if you noticed that, but they kept talking about how there were a lot of procedural issues in practice that week. And frankly, I'm not sure. I feel like thinking back, maybe Miami just made LSU look a little bit better than they are as well.
But what's interesting about the offensive play calling and the week that you just mentioned? I mean, I listened to Ed Orgeron's press conference beforehand, and he promised this kind of spread on offense and a sort of 50-50 split of run pass. But actually, it looked a lot more like what you've come to expect from the Tigers over the years. You know, tight formations, plenty of runs, the occasional play action passing, not a great deal of innovation. And yet it led to points. They were 33-3 up at one point, you know, with Joe Burrow, the Ohio State transfer, just doing enough, making a couple of big throws, but generally just doing enough, managing the game. And that's kind of what they needed, wasn't it? They just kind of needed somebody to come in because that defense is really, really good.
I love watching that defense. I love watching, there's some college football teams where certain units, and Virginia Tech were like this last night. They've got athletes and they just swarm around the ball and it's great to watch. And LSU epitomise that. I mean, there is always talent on LSU. Any first-year head coach, and Orgeron's not that, but could take over LSU and immediately have success because there is simply always talent on that team. And we saw it again. And I was really impressed by Joe Burrow. We said last week we thought he was essentially going to be the guy we were watching. They clearly held him back a little bit. I don't think they wanted to pass the ball too much against a very good Miami defense. They wanted to control the ball and do everything you said. But I just thought there were a few times on third down when a player needed to be made. He made a really good throw, often in the face of pressure. So I thought that was an impressive debut in a pretty tough spot.
We talk about NFL players, just one of those NFL players on that defense. We've touched upon Williams, the cornerback, but Devin White, the sort of rover linebacker, had a terrific game. The number 40, if you're watching it, if you watch LSU this weekend, he was everywhere, wasn't he? In the sort of display that makes you think, okay, that's a nailed on first round pick. Instincts, you'd like him to be a little bit half a second better in terms of his instinctive read and react, but in terms of just a player who's everywhere, who makes tackles, who can run like the wind, he's a really good player, isn't he?
He was the prototypical modern linebacker, isn't he? That's the thing. He's just so perfect for the modern game. And again, the kind of player that is just great to watch.
A strong start for the SEC this weekend. They went 13-1, only Tennessee lost. Big wins, especially as we mentioned, for LSU, also for Auburn, which we'll get to. But let's talk about quarterbacks and let's stay in the SEC. Alabama eased their way past Louisville with a fairly stunning performance from Tua Tagovailoa, who started at quarterback. Jalen Hurts came in and played some possessions. But this is Tua's team moving forwards, and he was mightily impressive, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are essentially saying that you can hand Alabama the national championship now.
I mean, it's disappointing. It's disappointing for teams to think that not only are the best team in the nation, but now they've got the best quarterback in the nation as well. That must be fairly damning for everybody else.
It's what fascinates me is I think it's going to be such a different Alabama team now. Because I must admit, I do think Tua is going to be turnover prone. I mean, there were a couple of players. Saturday night was one of those games where essentially everything he tried turned to gold. And that won't always happen, especially that first touchdown was insane. But so I do think that they'll turn the ball over more than they usually do. I think their defence, despite giving up almost no points, looked a little bit suspect. I know you thought the same, Simon, when we discussed it. So I think it's going to be a different Alabama team, but they in 10 years have not had a quarterback anything close to how talented this guy is. I mean, I'm already excited to see him play next week. He was spectacular, wasn't he?
This was
a more powerful version of Steve Young on the field of a college football game. It was just fabulous to watch.
I mean, the throw he made where he sort of was almost tackled and sort of bent over and then all of a sudden just throws this laser into the corner of the end zone was astonishing. But I was more impressed with the Jerry Jeudy touchdown in the second half than just the long touchdown that he had that was just dropped absolutely perfectly in stride, looked off the safety and then just almost as if he was, you know, chucking a sponge into a bucket at the Texas State Fair. It was just a phenomenal throw. But he just,
I do wonder how much of an impact he has on other teams' quarterback decisions.
Well, we're going to get to that in a sec, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, Clemson in particular, I think, have to respond.
Well, let's go there. I mean, Trevor Lawrence didn't start. Kelly Bryant did and played, you know, absolutely fine against Furman. He's a good college quarterback. But Lawrence came in and he threw three touchdowns, but he also made two other throws, including a sort of 18-yard out route that was just a laser, a proper NFL throw. Then made one deep throw that was caught in stride and would have been a touchdown if the receiver hadn't fallen down. And already the calls are coming from Clemson fans that, you know, Lawrence needs to start, in part because they want him to keep up with what's happening at Alabama. How long do you feel like the Kelly Bryant era will continue for?
Half a quarter of the next game if Bryant doesn't score a touchdown on the first drive.
They're playing Texas A&M, so we'll talk about that. But you know, they've got Texas A&M, then they're at Georgia Southern, then they're at Georgia Tech, Syracuse, Wake Forest, NC State. I mean, it's not a difficult schedule. Then they play Florida State, who, you know, who may have got them. I mean, they don't really have a tough game. We'll see. I mean, you know, their schedule is cupcake. It's Furman, yeah. Texas A&M, Georgia Southern, Georgia Tech, which could be a tough game, but only because of the way Georgia Tech, you know, their offensive scheme. Syracuse unranked, Wake Forest unranked, NC State unranked, Florida State, who you'd imagine will get their feet back under them, Louisville, who didn't look like they could, you know, they would pose a threat, Boston College, Duke, and South Carolina before you get to the ACC championship game. I mean, the flip side of that is that they might not have played anybody of any note before they get A, into a championship game, and then B, into a playoff where they're suddenly facing a massive step up. But
the other flip side is they really can't afford to lose a game.
Oh, absolutely. But it's not like there's not a game there where you wouldn't think, I tell you what, let's blood Trevor, because do you know what I mean? It's not like there's no game there you'd be afraid to put Lawrence in and announce him as the starter. Because, you know, let's just say he starts against Georgia Southern. That gives him a week to prepare for Georgia Tech. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not.
It's cupcakes all the way through. I can see it coming to a head this week because I just think I would expect Texas A&M to be well coached enough to make that game tight early on. And I think if that happens, then I think that they'll quickly turn to Lawrence. There was two guys. So we've mentioned Justin Fields and Trevor Lawrence on this pod. Justin Fields essentially just came in at the point when it was game over for Georgia, and you could tell there was a clear hierarchy between Jake Fromm and Justin Fields, I thought, in week one. I mean, other than Bryant taking the first series, there was no hierarchy between him and Lawrence in this game. I mean, they threw as many passes as each other. And I think that was telling. I think that was telling in terms of how much action they wanted Trevor Lawrence to have. And he's going to be the starter come the playoff. I mean, one way or another, if I look at it, I would think that if I was setting the roadmap out, I would see how it goes this week because I think this is the one challenging game in the next four or five. But you'd want them starting by the time the Florida State game comes, because for all we've criticised Florida State's performance last night, there's a lot of talent on the team. They've got a very good quarterback themselves. I think the game's in Tallahassee, if I remember rightly. So yeah, I mean, you'd want them starting and you'd want them comfortable by that game. And every sign suggests that he will be because he played a lot in this first game.
There's a, you know, there's a big challenge for him if playing this week against Texas A&M, isn't there? You know, in front of 100,000 fans on the road is a lot more different than, you know, the challenge that playing at home against Furman provided, isn't it? You know, in terms of just the scenario, the surroundings, the 12th man at the stadium, the noise, the expectation, Jimbo Fisher on the other sideline, that's a different feeling for a Trevor Lawrence than it was against the Paladins of Furman on Saturday.
And maybe that's the reason he played so much on Saturday, because they know they can see that on the horizon already, and they wanted to get his feet wet to a significant degree before this week.
Another young quarterback who did very well this weekend, true freshman Sam Hartman of Wake Forest, who sort of shined in their game over Tulane. An interesting performance, 300 yards passing. Wake look a good side with him at quarterback. He looked really, really impressive, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, and Tulane are a program that seemed to be on the rise after last year. So, I mean, I thought there were a lot of teams this week who really slip under the radar. I think Northwestern against Purdue was a really good win, and I think there are a lot of teams who essentially catapulted themselves into the conversation to be in and around the ranking areas. So, and I think Wake Forest are one of those teams.
Mentally tough. All the coaches talk about his mental toughness, Hartman, and you know, this kind of he's had quite a lot to go through, I think, as a teenager over his fairly young life, but including the death of his brother and, all sorts of things. But like you say, a very interesting time for Wake Forest in what doesn't look like the strongest of conferences, and they could actually, potentially make a little bit of noise. Some decent players on defense as well. One other young quarterback to talk about, because I want to get onto the West Coast, is JT Daniels at USC. Solid start for him, for the true freshman who didn't seem to miss a beat from Sam Darnold in many respects.
And frankly, they needed a solid performance from him, because I think they gave up about 300 rushing yards on defense, which is ridiculous. I mean, it's not like UNLV have this incredible Georgia Tech-like rushing attack. I didn't see anything in that game other than the highlights of Daniels, but that's an astonishing. I mean, they play Stanford this week, and Bryce Love had a really bad week one, but he could catapult himself firmly back into the Heisman campaign if that's any kind of indication of the run defense we're going to get from USC this year, because that wasn't impressive at all.
It wasn't, and Clay Helton's got to be concerned about that, hasn't he? I mean, that has to be a big worry for him.
Yeah, undoubtedly. And I mean, this is a huge year for Clay Helton, because he's another of those Ed Orgeron type coaches who's at a power program without being a blue chip power coach. You know, these guys who exude the personality of the program that they're in, and I feel like both of those guys are almost in a similar spot, where because they're not called Nick Saban, or even if when there was rumors of John Gruden going to Tennessee, you know, because they don't have that name recognition, they're immediately kind of under pressure. And this is a big year for him. Admittedly, they've got a true freshman at quarterback, so that probably buys him a little bit of time. But I think people want to see a USC team that is competitive on both sides of the ball. And I think they're in big trouble this week against Stanford.
I suppose the flip side to that those rushing statistics of 308 yards rushing they gave up at 7.5 yards a carry. 107 of those came on two plays, a fake reverse, which essentially bypassed everybody, and the other was a fake punt, which didn't involve the starting defense at all. And then Armani Rogers, the UNLV's mobile quarterback, made a lot of plays, you know, breaking as the pocket broke down, then got outside of contain and made yards that way. So I think I definitely think there's a flip side, a sort of caveat to that performance. But as we've touched upon, you know, Bryce Love coming into town, 18 of 29 in his opening game, he will be looking to significantly step up his level of performance after a very, very disappointing first week.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think the exciting part for Stanford is San Diego State are a team who I think beat them last year, who were a decent program in their own right. And to win that game against a team who's essentially shut down your ace card is an exciting time. And I mean, a lot of people now are talking about whether the Pac-12 can have a playoff representative, because Washington lost to Auburn, as we'll get into more depth on in a second. But I think Stanford are always a good program. David Shaw's a great coach. And they're another team who, admittedly, there's no pressure on David Shaw, because winning it all at Stanford is kind of impossible, given that they can only select from about 0.5% of America in terms of recruits. But they're always a really well-coached program, and there's never a year where I would be surprised to see Stanford maybe get themselves in and around that top four area.
Speaking of West Coast teams, notably from Los Angeles, a fairly inauspicious start to the Chip Kelly era at UCLA this weekend, with Oklahoma to come in a few days' time.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're seeing is this is a full rebuild, the Chip Kelly. I mean, they must have started more true freshmen than any other team.
11,
I think. On Saturday.
11
so,
true
yeah,
freshmen.
I mean, that's an insane number. And Wilton Spate, the guy from Michigan last year who we selected a quarterback, went out in the second quarter. So there were mitigating circumstances. I do believe in Chip Kelly. The only thing I would say is when he first came along, he essentially was the visionary behind the super up-tempo offense that a lot of colleges now run. And what that means is college defenses are completely ready for it. So whereas Kelly, early in his career, could essentially take lesser talented guys and make them into a really competitive top 10 team because the system he was running is so unique, those days are now gone. We've got a million programs in college football running it. Defenses are used to playing against it, which I think is the most important thing. Now, I'm very fascinated to see whether in stage three of his career, Chip Kelly can adjust again. Innovation is getting harder and harder in this era because of the access to information. And I think it's these guys like Kelly, who maybe would have had 30 years of innovative genius in the past, I think it's harder for them to keep kind of finding new spots. So I'm really interested to see how it goes for Chip Kelly, but I'll be judging it in 2 years' time, given how young the team is.
Yeah, I'm very much split on Kelly as to whether or not he's the genius that everybody makes out. I think it's interesting that, the you know, in terms of that fast break offense that people were expecting to transfer from Oregon, it was much more of a kind of a steady jog offense, really. I mean, most of the snaps were sort of 25 to 30 seconds in between, you know, after the end of the play had finished. And in Kelly's last season at Oregon, the Ducks ran 82.3 plays per game. Against Cincinnati at the weekend, they only ran 68 plays, which is a fairly significant drop for a team that's expected to play on the front foot, play fast break all the time.
Yeah, but do you wonder, what I wonder with that is it one, he doesn't have experienced enough guys versed in the system yet? I mean, I think his last year at Oregon, he had Mariota at quarterback, so he clearly had a ridiculous talent at quarterback. Or is it two, does Chip Kelly think that the super fast system is no longer the way to go and is adjusting? I mean, and that's what I'm interested to find out, really. Is it going to be different? Because, I mean, he's essentially spent his 12 months out of coaching visiting every coach that he respects for long periods of time. I mean, he's spent time with Kevin Sumlin, Bill Belichick, you know. He's got a lot of friends in coaching, and this is a guy who's shown a desire to learn all the time, new information. So I'm just fascinated to see if it looks any different, really.
Did you see Mike Leach's funky... I did. The big gulp, as he called it. He said he'd been working with... a former Wazoo grad who now worked for one of the big sort of engineering companies. Essentially, if you didn't see it, everybody lined up to the short side of the field. Offensive line was as it normally would be. There were three wide receivers to the left of the formation, a quarterback and a running back. But then the guy in the slot on the right-hand side of the formation had the ball. And he snapped.
I'm so glad you've explained this.
He snapped the ball back to the, well, I mean, there were essentially to the up back diagonally. Could have snapped it to the quarterback as well, but essentially it was a wildcat play, but with the ball being snapped by the slot receiver, and they ran it back to back two plays. And then afterwards, he was asked about it. And he said, "Yeah, it's called the big gulp. I've got all these kind of great funky things I'm going to pull out through the rest of the season." Then very far, I don't know if anybody's seen it, but he was then asking a question about what it was like playing at War Memorial Stadium, where Wyoming play at altitude. It's the highest, in terms of altitude, it's the highest stadium in Division I college football in Laramie. And he was asked about the question, and all of a sudden he went into this sort of 90-second kind of diatribe about jackrabbits and jackalopes, which is a jackalope is a kind of mythical American sort of deer with rabbit-like ears. He's such a great character, isn't he? America doesn't do national treasures, but if they did, Mike Leach would be front and centre, wouldn't he? He'd be kind of Judy Dench or Claire Balding.
Yeah, I mean, Washington State have essentially become my de facto second team because I love Mike Leach so much. For those who don't know, he had a long career at Texas Tech where he essentially pioneered parts of the air raid offense, and he's taken that to Washington State and actually done a really good job at Washington State. I mean, they were an absolute shambles when he took over, and they've had maybe three winning seasons on the spin now. And this was a great win for Washington State. I mean, they were favored to beat Wyoming, but they were also in that uncomfortable position of being the trendy upset pick to get beat, and they were behind at the point when he started running the funky plays. But they ended up winning by, I think, about 12 points. So it was a good win. And I would urge people to, if you're just getting into college football and you want to watch essentially what college football is all about, watch Washington State. Enjoy Mike Leach's press conference.
Yeah. Let's look at two teams that fell badly, Michigan and Washington. Washington, well, I mean, both of them really can't win the big one. Jim Harbaugh cannot get across the line against a top 25 team. And Washington, the game was there for the winning, and they just conspired to lose it. And we talked last week on the podcast about how Auburn's front seven could be dominant, and they were. And in the crunch time at the end of the game, they were able to back-to-back sacks of Jake Browning to essentially run out the clock. But Michigan looked dreadful on offense, didn't they? Dreadful.
I mean, 24-17 was the most flattering scoreline of the week in the favor of Michigan, because this was an absolute shambles in many ways. I mean, it was a shambles in which there were many missed opportunities. I mean, if you wanted to look at it from a positive light, I could pick out three players that if they went the other way, that probably should have gone the other way, Michigan would have won. However, that ignores the fact that, one, the plays happened, and two, the rest of the game was an absolute shambles. And I mean, Pep Hamilton, I don't want to pin all the blame on Jim Harbaugh, because Pep Hamilton now is continuously a shambles. He might be the most overrated coach in any level of football. This is a guy who was dreadful at the Colts when he was the offensive coordinator. Essentially, they regressed every year that he was there. And it's just been awful at Michigan. I mean, the Michigan offense genuinely just looks, it looks like analog in the digital age, to use the classic cliche. I mean, and it's more frustrating when you can see a guy, a quarterback, who Shea Patterson wasn't amazing, but I think a lot of that was a product of how he was being asked to play. You've now essentially got an exciting quarterback who you essentially need to take the reins off and let him go. And I think it's hard for Michigan to do that because they're so trusting in their defense, but it only gives you one way to win the game if you're so limited with what you do with him. Because all that needs to happen, which is what happens in this game, is the opposing offense has a really good scripted couple of first drives. It's 14-0, and then you're facing an uphill battle. And that's exactly what happened in this game. And there were many areas where it was a debacle. This was a team prepared and coached well against a team that wasn't, unfortunately.
Unfortunately for Michigan, then things spiraled a little bit out of control in the last sort of 24 hours. Braylon Edwards, the former Michigan receiver, turned NFL receiver, fourth overall pick by the Cleveland Browns in the Aaron Rodgers draft, essentially tweeted that he called out Cesar Ruiz, the center, called him weak, said that Shea Patterson, the quarterback, was scared, and then called the Michigan program trash. Harbaugh then and he did this under the auspices of working for the Big Ten Network, which he now does. Harbaugh came out yesterday in his media availability, said that none of that was true. It was not factual. Nobody in the program thinks anything about any player on the team, let alone the two players that he describes. Said that it was disappointing that a member of the Big Ten Network would attack the character of the players and of the school. It's ugly, isn't it? And it doesn't help Harbaugh's position either, does it? I mean, he can't control what Braylon Edwards tweets, but he's on the hot seat already a little bit, and now he's getting embroiled in this sort of pseudo social media row with an alumni. It's not a good look.
No, it's not. I mean, Braylon Edwards was a little bit out of order, I think, in what he said. He's been suspended by the Big Ten Network, and rightly so. But it kind of sums up the feeling in Ann Arbor. I mean, it's fascinating, this Jim Harbaugh tenure, because this is a great coach, and I mean, his record proves that. And he was a great coach up until three quarters of the way through year two in Michigan, when they were 9-0. They lost a tight game on the road at Iowa and then had the bad spot against Ohio State. But since that point, I think he's 9-9 in his last 18 games. And I mean, this record of not winning big games on the road stays with him. I mean, I essentially said last week that this was house money for Michigan, and it kind of was, because they've still got the whole Big Ten slate ahead of them, and at the end of the season, people aren't going to remember the particulars of this game. They're going to look at the score and say, well, you lost by 7 to Notre Dame. You had the ball left with 2 minutes left with a chance to go and tie the game. It's not a terrible loss, particularly in week one. But the worry for me is that the signs are there that this isn't going to be a good season. The offensive line was a shambles, and it was last year. Ed Warner, who we mentioned, has come in, a great touted offensive line coach who's done great jobs with programs like Ohio State. Everybody thought he was going to simplify the protections and it was going to change everything. It never at all. And I think now we need to start looking at whether this offense is really fit for modern college football.
0-17 on the road against ranked opponents, 1-6 against rivals, and that one win was that 9-3 win over Michigan State. I mean, are Michigan any better than Iowa at this point?
Well, we'll find out this season. And I mean, I think they're still loaded. I mean, the defence is really talented. I do think Patterson looked good in spots. I mean, I just don't think he was put in the position to succeed. I like to think that the penultimate drive, where they let him go a little bit, would encourage them to do that more. But maybe the next drive, where they let him go a little bit and he fumbled the ball, and we saw some of the turnover issues that certainly you pointed out, Simon.
But they still got Penn State.
It's going to be a fascinating few weeks. They've got a fairly easy schedule for a few weeks to try and pull it together. But
then Penn State, Michigan State, Wisconsin, Ohio State. I mean, it could get ugly for Harbaugh.
It could, yeah. But by the same account, it could get, you know, they'll look at it and think, well, we've still got a chance to really put ourselves in the national picture if we win those games. If I was a betting man right now, I would say that they don't win those games, though. So ugly is certainly the way I would go if I had to predict it.
What about Washington and Chris Peterson? I mean, Peterson came out and praised Auburn's defense, which was terrific. But are Washington out of the national championship picture now?
I thought so, but looking at what people are saying, I'm not sure there will be, because I think people would point to, unbeaten from here on in, I think they'd point to enough wins against the likes of USC.
And they travelled across the country to SEC Heartland on the road. They lost by less than a touchdown against.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't
top 10
similar. Similar to what I've just said about Michigan. If at the end of the season they've turned the year around, people aren't going to look at a 19-16 loss to a good Auburn team and say, oh well, that's a reason that you shouldn't be in. I mean, at the end of the day, they were competitive in the game, and they could quite easily have won it. It was just a weird game of two good teams who essentially just kept handing it back to the other. I mean, Auburn dominated the second half and were only up by single points. Washington completely dominated the second half and essentially barely ever led in the game. I mean, there were numerous drives where they missed field goals. They had players that took them out of field goal range. So it wasn't the best game, but it was a fascinating one.
Again, their schedule: North Dakota this weekend, Utah. Arizona State could be an interesting game. We'll get to Arizona State in a moment. BYU, UCLA, who we've talked about. Oregon, you're going to want to put a pasting on Oregon just because that will help with the voters. Colorado, Cal. The big game, November the 3rd against Stanford. That could be, you know, for all the pieces of the pie, as it were, and could get them right back into the running ahead of Washington State, and then the Pac-12 championship, depending on what happens elsewhere, there's a chance. It's a slim one, I think. I really do think it's a slim one, but there's a chance, isn't there?
I think if they go unbeaten, they'll get voted in, and I'll disagree with it, I think, but they will. So they've still got a chance. But I mean, that's easier said than done. I mean, a nine game schedule against your own conference is never easy for any team. So that. They're one loss away from being out, and if you had to bet, you would say they will probably lose another game from here on out.
You are listening to the ESPN Player Gridiron College Football Show with me, Simon Clancy, and Gridiron Magazine editor Matt Sherry. That's kind of it for looking back at last week. Let's kick ahead to what's happening this weekend. No major games on the slate, and we'll look at the Heisman Trophy as well before we go off in 10 or 15 minutes. No major games on the slate this weekend, but things that sort of stand out for me: Mississippi State against Kansas State, first game for Nick Fitzgerald. We look at projecting players to the next level in part on this podcast. Fitzgerald has some fans at the NFL level. We saw him in person from the sidelines last year, almost beat Alabama. Severely broken ankle in the bowl game, was suspended for week one, but he has talent, doesn't he, Nick Fitzgerald? And it should be interesting to see him back on the field and see where he is mentally, but also see where he is physically.
Yeah, and I mean the suspension, which I'm not really sure what it was for. I've not that news. I knew he'd been suspended, but when they initially broke it, it was just a violation.
Yeah, I don't think it's come out.
I'm not sure if any more's come out, but that's not a good look. So I think all eyes are on him this week, and it'll be an interesting week to watch him for that reason, because I think he'll want to put in a big performance. People were starting to talk about him as an NFL guy before the season. So a big week for Nick Fitzgerald, really.
Absolutely. Keaton Thompson started for Mississippi State and played well. They won. Georgia-South Carolina is a very interesting SEC game. The Gamecocks are always dangerous, especially with Jake Bentley at quarterback. Another passer with the NFL potential, and a very experienced offense that actually could test a young Georgia defense.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, this is Georgia's, on the subject of cupcake schedules, Georgia's might be the kind of top tier of that. But this is one of the games that you look at and think, early in the season, there is an opportunity there. South Carolina ended last season very well with a New Year's Six Bowl win over Michigan. They're 1-0, as Georgia are. So, yeah, this is going to be... If you're going to pick upset alert game, I don't think it will be an upset, but one where you watch it in the hope that certainly it could get interesting. This is the one this week.
I have an upset alert game, which I'll get to.
I do as well, a different one. Minute.
Clemson, Texas A&M, we've talked about. Just a very quick word on A&M. A good start for Jimbo Fisher, but they're going to need a Johnny Manziel type of game from Kellen Mond if they're going to beat Clemson, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, a great start. I know it was limited opposition, but I think the set a yardage record in offensive yards, which is a lovely start for Jimbo. And I just think they need to be competitive in this game. I think it will be a great look for Jimbo after week one. And that contract that he got, if they can essentially take a Clemson team who, along with Alabama, I think are head and shoulders above the rest into the fourth quarter, I think would be a good day for Texas A&M.
The most intriguing game between ranked teams we've touched upon a little bit, USC-Stanford, but we should reiterate, Bryce Love needs a big game, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about Heisman moments, they often come in big games, and regardless of whether USC's run defence is as bad as it looked in week one, at the end of the season, if people look at Bryce Love and he's ran for 200 yards against USC, they'll just think 200 yards against USC. So if the Heisman campaign is going to take off and not essentially stop before it's even out of the gate, this is a week where Bryce Love needs to shine.
So my upset special of the week is Michigan State travelling to play Arizona State. Herm Edwards' side, big win on opening weekend. Michigan State limped past Utah State and were down late in that game and could have lost. It was fairly stunning for Mark D'Antonio. Arizona, a very interesting team, interesting offense, led by potentially the first wide receiver that could come off the board in next year's draft, and Keel Harry. What do you think about that? Do you think that will we see the same Michigan State team in? Because if we do, they could be in big trouble.
I think they have a habit, don't they, Michigan State, of starting seasons slowly. So, absolutely, they could. I mean, I was stunned. I thought Arizona State might be, if not upset alert, I certainly thought that they would have the spread covered against them. And that never happened. I mean, it was a great start for Herm Edwards, who's essentially been a laughingstock of the off-season. I tell you what, if Herm Edwards can go and beat Michigan State, that would really shut a lot of people up, wouldn't it? So that would be... I think they've got every chance. I mean, Michigan State were... I mean, we can talk about Michigan being unimpressive, but Michigan State and Penn State were easily more unimpressive given the calibre of opposition last week. So they've got a lot to prove. And that quickly brings me on. I think Pitt against Penn State is another potential upset alert, because Pitt always seem to be a team who essentially can beat a big gun. I mean, I think they beat Miami last season when Miami were ranked in the top four. So that could be another game that Pitt are no pushovers. So that could be another interesting upset alert game.
Nice. But I mean, going back to the Michigan State game for just one sec, Brian Lewerke, the Michigan State quarterback, is going to need... He played well in that win. And again, another NFL quarterback with potential first-round possibilities. He's going to need a similar style of game, isn't he, in terms of if they're going to avoid that defeat against Arizona State. Because the atmosphere there will be bouncing. And Arizona State, I think, 9 sacks, only gave up 2 yards rushing in the win in week one. They're not to be messed with.
Absolutely not. And that's another one of those stadiums where the atmosphere can quickly get on top of you there. That's a really kind of lively college town. So the fan base will be really good. On the Michigan State quarterback, I thought in bad weeks for Michigan State and Penn State, their two quarterbacks came out of it and kind of led them down the field at the end of the game when they needed to. So I think both of those guys, Trace McSorley of Penn State as well, came out of week one with a decent amount of credit.
Let's have a look at the Heisman list, in part because it allows us to talk about a couple of quarterbacks that we ordinarily would have talked about elsewhere. We both talked about Trevor Lawrence as being our sort of Heisman guy. I think at this point, Tagovailoa probably jumps to the top of the class.
Possibly. I mean, I'm putting Kyler Murray at the top of the class at this point. I mean, he was my kind of outsider pick, and I thought he was incredible. I mean, a lot of people thought FAU would play Oklahoma colors, and we haven't spoke about Oklahoma yet. I thought actually they might have been the most impressive team in week one. That looked like classic trap game, and they absolutely... I mean, they had the backups in at midway through the second quarter, and we're up 42-0.
I mean, so they ran up 63 points, didn't they? I mean,
yeah. And Kyler Murray, I mean, he was incredible. This guy can really throw it as well, by the way. He can sling it. He's accurate. He made some incredible throws into windows that were tiny. I mean, if this guy was bigger, he might be an NFL prospect himself.
He was so impressive. He was the 9th overall pick in the Major League Baseball draft, and that's pretty much where his future will lie. In the column, the kind of weekend review column that you can read on the Gridiron website, I went with Tagovailoa at 1. Will Greer of West Virginia, who had a terrific game, 25 of 34, 429 yards, 5 touchdowns. Dwayne Haskins, the Ohio State quarterback, who set a record for the most yards and touchdowns ever by a Buckeye quarterback making his first start, 5 touchdowns again, 22 of 30 for 313 yards as Ohio State ran up, 77 points in that opening game, which, you know, Urban who kind of thing. I kept Trevor Lawrence at 4, and then Jonathan Taylor of Wisconsin, the running back, who had a very solid debut, 128 some odd yards. Mackenzie Milton I was very impressed with in his first game. I thought Jake Fromm played well. I thought the kid at Auburn played very well, especially in the first quarter, just kind of calming everything down.
Jarrett Stidham
played very well. And yeah, you mentioned the guy that you mentioned there as well. Very, very impressive. Justin Herbert as well at Oregon. Didn't throw many, but I think he only threw 10 passes, 5 of which went for touchdowns, which is phenomenal. But yeah, a lot of good performances, a lot of interesting freshman performances as well. I don't know if you saw Rondale Moore of Purdue. He had 313 all-purpose yards against a really good Northwestern side. And this kind of ridiculous 76-yard run that kind of made you think a little bit of that sort of Ted Ginn era Ohio State. He was a true freshman who joined Purdue after decommitting from... Where did we start?
Texas.
We started at Texas and we finish at Texas, who lost Rondale Moore, who looks like a superstar in the making. He decommitted from Tom Herman's outfit and went to Purdue, and that could be one of the reasons why Texas is 0-1 and Tom Herman is firmly on the hot seat.
And I know which coach I'd take out of Texas and Purdue as well.
Me too.
Jeff Brown's one of the rising stars in college football.
Absolutely. That's all from us this week. Don't forget, you can sign up for a monthly or annual pass to get ESPN Player's extensive coverage of college football, which includes more than 700 games this season, live and on demand, plus 3 channels simulcast direct from the US, including ESPNU, the SEC Network, and the Longhorn Network. Access to a range of great documentaries from the ESPN Films catalogue, which we talked about earlier on, but also includes things like Roll Tide, War Eagle, Elway to Marino, Catholics v. Convicts, part of that 30 for 30 lineup. And if that wasn't enough, when you sign up, you get a 7-day free trial. We should be back next
week. And also, I've got one more thing to say on that. We are currently running a competition at gridiron-magazine.com for a free subscription. So enter that and you might not even need to pay. You get a year's free subscription.
There you go. What more could you want? We should be back next week to review week 2, look ahead to week 3. We'll sort of have a newfangled Heisman list where we'll try and make out that we know what we're talking about. I hope you've enjoyed it. We shall be back next week. Have a great week. See ya.
The situation in the Pacific is worse than reported.
The Japanese are planning something big.
What's the target?
Midway.
From the director of Independence Day.
A couple dozen planes. It's all Japanese fleet.
We got the order to launch!
Discover the incredible true story.
Today we're going to be underdogs.
Of the World War II battle.
Good luck, boys.
Fire!
Midway. Download and keep now.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step 1. Go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step 2. Collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step 3. Play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games. All for free?
Step 4. Unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit RightRug.com. RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.